Love this podcast? Support this show through the Acast supporter feature. It's up to you how much you give, and there's no regular commitment. Just click the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Fiction. Science fiction. Horror. Fantasy. Crime. LGBT. Thriller.
You have now entered the House of Mystery with your hosts, Eric Shapiro, David North Martino, John Copenhaver, and Al Warren.
Heard on Casey.
106.5
FM Los Angeles,
102.3 FM Riverside,
and 1050 AM Palm Springs.
All right, welcome back into the House of Mystery, and of course, I'm Al Warren. Now, joining me for the co-host job today, we've got Mr. Mike Brown from Dark Poutine Canada. How you doing, Mike?
I'm back.
I'm
doing okay. Lots of crazy stuff going on in my life. My book is done. My audiobook has been completed, and it's going to be released on November 2nd.
That's exciting.
Yeah.
That's real exciting. Oh, so you actually recorded your own audiobook too, didn't you?
I did, and I really think that the people who recorded it with me should get medals for having to listen to me.
Yeah. Oh, I'm sure they've heard a lot worse.
Mm-hmm.
Well, no, I find that hard work. I can't do my own books.
It was grueling. It was 5 hours a day for 4 days. So
yeah.
80,000 words.
That's a bit much for me. I can't speak anyway. I'm on radio. So we've got an interesting show today. And today I came across a guy that worked on a case on one of the books that I wrote years ago, but we were both doing a show for CNN. It was kind of interesting. And so anyway, we've got Mr. Jim Van Allen. Thank you for taking the time to talk with us today.
My pleasure, Alan.
Well, Jim, before we get going into this, I find it really interesting, your background. How did you decide that this was what you wanted to do, like criminal profiling and being a detective and being part of the Ontario Police Department? Where did that come from for you?
Well, I, from a early age, I've always been interested in police work. I had a brother that was on the provincial police, always made it sound interesting. I decided to give it a go in my mid-20s, and very quickly I found my interest was drawn towards criminal investigation, and that's the way I handled my career. And I went into, I did the normal day-to-day general duties, policing in uniform that a lot of us do, but the provincial police also does a lot of criminal work in uniform as well. But about halfway through my career at the 16-year mark, after being a plainclothes detective in a district crime unit, an opportunity came up to advertise the second criminal profiling job ever on the OPP, and I thought that would be very interesting to pursue. Put my name in a field of 10 people and was lucky enough to qualify for the position, was selected, through a 2 year after your intensive training period, went to the FBI Academy and worked with the FBI profiling unit, a bunch of other experienced profilers in Virginia, Ottawa, and around, and worked with my mentor at the provincial police, Detective Inspector Kate Lines. And it was a learn as you go, a lot of self-study, a lot of interesting courses, highly specialized courses. And it all fits together with the experience that you've developed over the years as an investigator. And I was able to try and help other investigators with the specialized information that I had been given, because I knew what they needed. I had done that job. I knew how they did their job and how I could hopefully make things easier for them, help them understand the crime they were investigating a little bit better.
I know it's a broad topic, but can you help to demystify the idea of criminal profiling for us?
Absolutely. I would love to do that, because that's one of the things that I'd often encounter is people think that there's a lot of deep psychology or something here, and there really isn't. It's a lot of common sense logic. The process is very close to the process that an experienced and intuitive criminal investigator will use anyways, but we augment that with some applied criminal psychology. We've been taught sometimes it's more in the field of normal psychiatry, depending on the case you're looking at. And we were allowed to do this on a daily basis, and this was our focus, I would see a lot more crimes. We did a lot of our work for the provincial police, and about 50-some percent for outside agencies as well, all municipal departments in Ontario, some in different provinces, some in the States. I've worked with people in Europe and Australia as well. And I estimate that I have been exposed to, in one way or another, approximately 850 different homicides. And that's a lot of different cases from which you draw a lot of experience. You see common patterns in some of the crimes that you look at. And that's what we would do. We would try and recognize various crimes, or out of the crime scene findings, we would try and recognize different criminal personalities that have committed other similar crimes. I've walked into crime scenes, looked at it, and I knew, recognized that I had looked at 4, 5 similar crimes in the past. And there's an intuitive logic that if you know the outcome of those previous 4 or 5 crimes, and you're looking at the same one now, chances are that offender might match certain important characteristics that those other crimes did. And you'll go through and analyze the different crime scene findings and the various events that happened in the crime, and assess other factors, develop, theories about what's going on, test your theories to the data that you're looking at, develop a profile, and propose various suggestions, investigative alternatives to investigators that might positively further their investigations.
And as a profiler, I'd imagine that going through over 800 crimes like that, how does that change you? How does it make you into a different person?
I don't really think it does. I mean, certainly you see a lot of graphic violence, but a lot of people deliberately channel their investigations this way. Not all get to the privilege that I got actually doing this type of work. But if you went into it You have sort of asked for it. Now, I've seen a lot of graphic violence that now being repaired, I really don't miss too much. There's certain things, of course, you can't unsee once you've seen them. But, even the tougher cases, we were very duty oriented, and somebody had to do it. We had the training, and we were the guys, and the guys and the girls that were chosen and developed to do this. So that was our job, and we did it. And I was consider myself very fortunate to have done it. Some people can only do it for 5 years, and they feel they've had enough, and that's fair. Everybody has their own limit, and if you feel that this is taxing you or bothering you, this working in violent crime, and it's not for everybody, then you should get it for your own benefit, the benefit of your family, and find something else that you can chase with your passion. I ended up doing it for approximately 15 and a half years, and I've still continued to do aspects of the job even in retirement.
Well, I just wonder, but does your opinion of people change? I mean, no. after seeing so many crimes, like when you are out and about, do you actually, you know what I'm like, do you sort of think of someone as possibly a criminal before you know what I mean? Like, do you put you on edge right away?
You can't help when you're in the business of analyzing behavior, not to do it on an almost daily basis. You shouldn't be taking this home and doing it with your family or anything like that. But you notice different things about people. People cast off a lot of signals about themselves anyways. That's human nature. We telegraph a lot about ourselves anyways, from the way you talk, your grooming, the clothing that you wear, your different logos, tattoos. It's all a lot of self-expression, and we put it out there for anybody to see if that's who we are, and that's important to our self-identity. But it doesn't cause you to look at any specific person suspiciously or anything like that. You know, we were there to concentrate on the criminal personalities that were putting public safety at risk. And that was our focus, not, the people in your community, your neighbors, things like that. I cannot look at a large group of people and decide who is the most likely to be the next criminal. But when the crime is committed, and you go and look at what the person did, what the interaction was between the offender and the victim, then all of our analysis and our lessons that we've learned are fair to employ in the investigation of this crime, if that answers your question.
Yeah. So when you're profiling one of these crimes, do you follow through to see if you've got it right later?
I would have liked to have been able to do that, but unfortunately, everybody's busy. We were exceedingly busy. We always had a number of cases on the go, some simultaneously, like maybe six, seven cases on the go, some of them murders or other cases, and you'd be going from one case to another a lot of the time. We didn't have time to get back and reconnect with the investigators to find out the outcome. Sometimes people would call us, let us know what the outcome was, but not always. In the major ones, the important ones, and the ones we were involved with longer on a long-term basis during the investigation, we would have a higher likelihood of finding out what the outcome of all the investigation was, who was caught, what they were like.
Who's the scariest person you ever profiled? Other than me.
A gentleman, well, not gentleman, an individual in the city of Toronto who committed a sexual homicide against a female realtor and ended up sexually assaulting, killing her, and it was a real whodunit type of crime. And I was called in by the Toronto police. And, of course, you know, there are always many different theories that go along with an investigation. Some people thought that maybe someone in a business relationship with this victim killed her. Other people thought it might have been an ex-boyfriend, ex-lover type of thing may have killed her, or perhaps she was the victim of a stranger sexual predator. And I looked at the case, and I was confident that it was in the realm of the sexual predator that was not necessarily connected to her, but they had a similar connection to this office building in which the murder occurred. And, quite unexpectedly, I met with the victim's family and gave them an explanation of what I felt and why I felt it and what I thought the murder was about. And the victim's sister actually went back based on some of the information in my profile and did her own little investigative work, which identified information which led to the killer's identity. He had done a couple of knife point sexual assaults and had done prison time for those two sexual assaults. And he was identified, he was apprehended, he was convicted of the sexual homicide of the realtor, and I think he would have gone on to commit other sexual homicides if he had not been caught. He was a real concern, a real risk to public safety, and high risk to vulnerable segment of the public, women in downtown Toronto.
Wow. So profiling helps to convict a lot of folks, but has any of your profiling experience ever led to maybe somebody being exonerated?
Well, we very little of it. I was one time involved in a case that, you know, it generally comes by phone, and an investigator called me up and he said, we're investigating a murder and we've got a woman who is covered in head to toes with bruises. The husband that she was living with has a record of domestic violence against a previous partner. They had charged him with assault, and she had died over the weekend, and their intention on Monday morning was to charge him with the woman's murder. And I, over the phone call, I said, tell me more about this, and what did you find, and what did you see? And it sounded not really specific enough to be considered a murder. And with there was a lot of alcohol involved in this couple's relationship, a lot of alcohol. They were heavy drinkers, and they were drinking heavily at the time of the death. And I said, you want to be careful with this one, because I have seen a number of cases where alcohol on a real drinking binge start banging into things so often that they're covered in really, really serious bruises. But yet the bruising is different. The bruising is more very concentrated. It's larger and more diffuse, and looks more like a hemorrhage under the skin. And the location of the bruising doesn't really match where somebody would be hit in a violent fight. It's not on the head. It's not on the torso or something like that. Her bruises tended to be on, you know, the joints that would bang into things as a intoxicated person was stumbling around the house and falling down. And it looks different. It still looks pretty serious because of all the bruising, but it's not bruising that we associate with homicidal assault. And ended up going down right that afternoon because this was a Sunday and they were going to upgrade the charges on the Monday. So we had to look at the evidence, look at the photography that was available. And my opinion to the lead investigator was, this is not even a crime. This is one of those instances of a heavy, heavy drinker, binge drinking, falling down, maybe banging her head, maybe getting an intracranial bleed, which caused the death. But of course, you would have to wait for benefit of the autopsy to confirm that. But I said, we need to pump the brakes on this decision to charge him. And right now, I believe you got an innocent man in custody for an assault that never happened. And there was a round of consultations between investigators, the regional pathologist, the regional crown attorney, and a few other folks that were involved. And they were all in agreement. And we were able to take essentially an innocent man out of custody to prevent him from being charged with a much more serious offense that he was not responsible for.
When you have a high-profile case like Russell Williams, which we both kind of know a little bit about, you know a lot more than I do, of course, but on high-profile cases, does it make any difference to you as a profiler?
Well, it, certainly high-profile cases add a lot of pressure to everybody involved in the investigation. There's a lot of public concern that they might be in danger, their relatives might be in danger. Yes, it's it adds a lot more pressure. It's a lot more things are at stake. You don't want to make a mistake. I mean, we're human like everybody else, and to err is human. If you're providing 200 opinions a year, chances are each one of those opinions is not going to be right. But we try to be way more right than we aren't. And sometimes your opinions are able to help solve the case, help get a confession or important admissions from a person. And you know that you also have a potential to mislead an investigation as well. And that was, you know, my worst nightmare, that you know, I would try not to let that happen. But a big case is important. It's important to the victim, the victim's family, everybody in the community, justice as a whole, reputation of the police service. There's a lot going on there. And we try and do our best job, and we try and help the police do the most efficient investigation they can based on what they have to work with. Now, the Russell Williams case, I had involvement in some of those, but the real serious developments in that case occurred in the Jennifer Lloyd case, and it was actually one of my or two of my former colleagues that were on site dealing with that, not me. It's luck of the draw, who got the phone call at the time, who responded to this particular crime, and it was a different profiler that went to that one, and that's when everything lined up against Russell Williams, and his involvement in all those crimes became known.
Well, he was a pretty tough cookie in the sense that I don't think, would you guys have realized that it would have been a colonel like that? Would that be something that would come up in a profile, someone like who had done military and all that?
Well, I was in one victim's home, his first homicide victim. And at that time when I was there, it was an exercise in prioritizing a couple of suspects that they had at that particular time. And this was very, very early in the investigation. There was nothing in that house to suggest a colonel was in the house or Russell Williams was responsible for this crime. There was one suspect that had a military background, and due to a number of circumstances, my opinion was the investigator should concentrate more on him than the other two suspects that existed at the time. And in retrospect, both were in the military, both were pilots, both were connected to that victim. Both were, you know, colleagues of hers to some degree. And that was interesting, but I don't believe it would, the profile would have been written to say high-ranking military officer. It just wasn't there. The primary focus was somebody knew her. I was convinced it wasn't a stranger type crime where somebody just decided to go into that house. Somebody knew that victim was in there and went into that house to access her. And that was that part was accurate.
Cases that you had sent me earlier to talk about, and one that really stuck out was the police officer that was arrested for murder of his girlfriend and an undercover psychic operation. Now, so that sounded pretty intriguing. What happened in that case?
Well, there was a woman in the Greater Toronto area went missing and had last been known to be at her boyfriend's house, and he happened to be a serving police officer. And of course, you know, trying to establish a timeline in the victim's life, he was interviewed, and he said, "She left my house, everything."
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Was good. I expected to see her again. And I don't know where he would have gone, but I'm concerned as well. And he was a different type. He was not immediately believed by the investigators. And they thought that because her trail had dried up after she was in his house, that relationship might have something to do with explaining her disappearance. And there was just no other activity going on in her life that would have suggested some type of conflict that would have led to her disappearance and or death. And very uncharacteristic of her to just go missing like that. So, of course, we feared the worst for her at the time. In looking at that officer, the victim and their group of friends that all socialized together, one of the common patterns was they tended to believe in psychics, and one of the associates or acquaintances in the group considered herself a psychic as well. And she said, oh yeah, we all really believed in it. So again, trying to select the most appropriate investigative strategy, we decided that maybe one of the things we could employ was an undercover psychic. And we selected an officer who could fit the bill, he could act the part, and he was pretty experienced. And so we set up a ploy whereby the undercover officer was supposed to be a psychic from Los Angeles, and a very good one. And he had helped the police on a number of successful investigations, and he had agreed to coming to Toronto to a psychic fair that just happened to be occurring at that time. And he was going to volunteer his time to come over to the officer's house to see if he could pick up any psychic vibes that might explain the circumstances of the victim's disappearance. And, of course, we researched what psychics do and how they go through their processes just to have the lingo down and make it reasonable. We thought that the police officer might check the credentials of the psychic. And so we established a fake website in California where we were supposed to be from. And we had some of our colleagues in the United States that are, you know, very experienced police officers, and they were prepared, if contacted, to vouch for the psychic. Not necessarily believe in him, but say, yeah, he was right. He really helped us. He came up with a few good ideas for us. And that was all put into play, and the psychic undercover officer was supposed to arrive in Toronto at the police officer's house on a Sunday evening when he was supposed to fly into Ontario from Los Angeles. And that Friday night, the police officer who was the suspect called the investigators. And he said, I want you guys to come over to my house. There's something I need to show you. So with great apprehension, they went over to the house, not knowing what they were going to run into. He invited them into their home, his home, and said, she's behind that wall. He had killed her in the house and put her body in a barrel with acid, and he had sealed the top of the barrel and then put it and built a false wall in front of the barrel, and the remains were behind the barrel, or behind the false wall. And so they were able to recover the victim's body, interview the offender, and they got a number of admissions and confessions that he was responsible for her death. Undercover operations are used a lot in police work for drugs, their investigations, and back in the 90s, it started being used in homicides as well, and quite successfully. We've used them a number of times, and to a fair bit of success, I would say, and have cleared a number of homicides that might not have been cleared otherwise. And it's just our process of trying to understand the suspect, their motive, why they did what they did to this particular victim, and give them a new acquaintance that they are going to trust and bond with, and make a voluntary discussion about what they did and why they did it. And there's obviously a huge gain in evidence for us when we do that. and that certainly led to successfully clearing that murder.
I guess that's in reference. That would really be like the Mr. Big Sting.
Sometimes we have used the Mr. Big Sting. That one wasn't. That was, you know, and we try and get away from Mr. Big because we're concerned that it's going to be recognized by offenders, yet it's still highly successful because most offenders are motivated by a greed situation. But this one was different. Mr. Big invites a suspect to join an existing criminal organization, and maybe there's rules that the suspect has to do before he gets into the organization, or there's some type of benefit. We'll take care of your problems if you join us. And, you know, he often has been doing low-level criminal activity, non-violent type things, deliveries and things like that for money. And, it's a slow process of gaining trust and getting them to join you. But then Mr. Big, the leader of the organization, comes in and discusses his involvement with them. And sometimes there's confessions or admissions there. Our undercover operation was different than that. There was no Mr. Big in this. It was exploiting the suspect's belief in other people's psychic ability. And he was so concerned that this psychic was so competent and experienced that he would be able to come up with some psychic information that he had been killed in the house. And he decided that rather than face that, he would turn himself in first. So we were quite surprised. It was highly successful. It didn't cost a lot for us to do that. A bunch of phone calls, arranging cooperation of other people, planning, preparation, and it was just a little bit of theater to convince the suspect that something was unfolding that might well uncover his involvement and lead to his apprehension. He decided to end it first.
Yeah. Did you guys ever really use psychics for any cases, or is that just more television again?
No, that's television. I mean, the police have been contacted by a number of psychics that want to offer information or, you know, the theories they have. I haven't seen too many. I've seen a couple. It's generally pretty non-specific type of information that really, you know, wouldn't go to help somebody. I personally don't have a lot of confidence in psychics. But if you do, I'm going to try and exploit that for the benefit of the investigation.
Yeah.
But no, I have no personal involvement where psychic information drastically aided a police investigation.
Does it make it a lot harder when there's a cop involved, like as a suspect?
Yeah, that's something very distasteful for the other investigators, and the fact that he has committed, like in the case we were discussing about, he has committed the most serious criminal offense that anybody can commit in North America, in my opinion, unless you're multiple murders. But a single incident murder, it doesn't get any more serious than that. And that's not the conduct that we expect from our colleagues, of course. But we're duty bound to investigate it to the best of our abilities as completely as we can. It's unfortunate. I mean, it was unfortunate for the military when Russell Williams was captured, given his high rank and everything else too. But I mean, standing back, the police did nothing that would have impacted that officer killing his girlfriend. The military did nothing that would impact Russell Williams from committing all his various crimes. These are individual decisions made by each offender that they are going to pursue this criminal career or criminal act, and they are the sole architects of the of everybody's trauma that they put everybody under, and the consequences of what they face. They are solely responsible for doing it. You can look back at a person's background and say, okay, there's this in their background, that was unfortunate, this happened at a formative period of their life, and it maybe helps to understand how the person evolved and why they decided what they did, but it certainly doesn't go to condone what they did. So, I mean, we look at a person's background, their lifestyle, a lot of traits that drive their behavior, to get that understanding and to know how to deal with them. If we are going to concentrate on suspect A, I'm going to want to know everything about that person that I can find, who they live with, how they live, what do they do for a living, what's their recreational activities, what's their relationship activities. We'll go and, if necessary, interview previous girlfriends and ex-wives and find out a lot about them there. We'll look at criminal histories and activities that they've been involved with. If it's available, I'll even watch previous interviews of the person to see if, how they lie. Do they lie? How do they lie? When do they lie? What are their unique phrases that they use in their language? And I will structure an interview strategy with a lot of that in mind, because I like to say everybody has their own frequency. And if I'm going to interview you, I have to go to your frequency. I don't expect you to come to my frequency. So I'm going to learn everything I can about you, and I'm going to plan the best possible approach to sit in a room with you and create an atmosphere in which you feel prepared to voluntarily discuss your involvement in a crime with me. And that often is, as a result of rapport building, conveying a non-judgmental approaches to a person, understanding similar value system that the other person has. If I'm interviewing you on a serious crime, I'm going to be your best friend in that room. I'm going to see the world through the perspective that you do and try and lead you to discuss your involvement in the crime. And that being the case, my job is over once the crime is solved, and we're off to the next challenge.
Okay, I admit it. I did it.
Oh, no.
I did it. I broke down already. So now, what have you moved on to since you retired from the police force? Now you do an investigation solutions network. What's that all about?
I have taken a lot of the experience and training that I've had, and on retirement, it's all transferable to the private sector, and I still offer my services as a certified criminal profiler and as a threat and risk assessment consultant. And a lot of what we get are cases of employers that have an employee of concern that they're worried about. Perhaps somebody has made a threat to do something against other employees, or on termination, they're threatening to come back and harm people, things like that, or circumstances, aggression is building up at work, and they're concerned that they're going to have a violent crime on their hands. And what we'll do is assess the person, their behavior, what they're doing, and the situation that exists at the time, what's going to happen in the foreseeable future, and we'll give them an opinion as to how much risk this individual poses, if any. And a lot of it is low risk. Maybe people expressing a little bit of frustration, people that make a poorly decided threat, poorly timed threat, but they don't really have a lot of personal commitment to carry out that threat. There's a lot of threats that are made, but the art in this, if there is art, is to decide who's going to carry out on the threat they made or do some other type of harm. So that's the threat assessment part of it. And then the risk assessment or risk management part of it is, now what are we going to do that's going to increase everybody's safety and security? How are we going to manage this individual? What are we going to do around him that could make the situation better? Or how do we improve the security around the organization to prevent or lessen the risk of somebody coming in to committing harm against other employees that are left behind. And we still, we get a lot of those. We get a lot of criminal investigations, which are being done on the private side. People aren't prepared to go to the police. They want to retain the autonomy over the investigation, and they want some experienced opinions on how best to deal with it. Is this likely to continue? How do we protect our assets the best? And we try and give the best possible advice we can. Sometimes it's a quick opinion going out to them, and sometimes we're involved with them over a period of days, weeks, or months to help them walk through this particular incident that they're dealing with, because it still comes down to safety issues and preventing violence. And there's a lot of carryover from what I did for many, many years at the provincial police.
That's great. So now what's the website for that? We can give it out and have it up on our website too. So
it's Investigative Solutions Network, Inc. And it's in Canada. It's based in Pickering, Ontario, and it'll be a .ca extension at the end of it. But if you just Google that, Investigative Solutions Network, you're going to find us, the website, services that are offered, the people that are working for the company. And I mean, a lot of us have come out of the policing realm, have had involvement with each other. We know what each other's skill sets are. We've done cases together. The CEO, Dave Perry, is a former homicide investigator for the Toronto Police Service. And Dave and I, Dave called me in on a couple of his high-profile cases, and I was able to give him my opinion and suggestions as to what would be most successful. And both cases were solved, both homicides against children that were quite disturbing in their own right, and they were successful.
Do you think the crimes are changing somewhat nowadays? Like the when people profile serious crimes now, is there some changes to the way people do crimes?
Sure. Time changes. We change. Crime changes as well. You know, everything about the social environment is changing right now. Crime statistics are changing, and I was just looking at them the other day, and in the 10 years that I've been retired, one of the notable findings is that there's more violent crime being committed by strangers. It always used to be this 84 to 86% of violent crime committed by somebody known to you, a family member, an intimate partner, a co-worker, an acquaintance, relative of some description, friend, something like that. And approximately 12% of crimes would be committed by strangers, somebody with no previous existing relationship. And, you know, those are sometimes the more concerning ones and harder to solve because you don't have that pre-existing relationship. Well, the number of stranger crimes are increasing. It's up to about 16% now, which is still significant. 16% of anything is significant. And we're going to have to monitor that. And, you know, we're seeing spikes in different types of crime. We're seeing more attacks against police officers. We're seeing increase of crimes of extremism. We're seeing more hate crimes going on. So that's one of the things that we would be expected to do when we were working with the Ontario Provincial Police, to stay on top of crime trends and crime stats and stay with it and know where we were and what would be the most likely explanation for this crime, and even try and forecast a little bit, where are we going? What are we going to need? How are we going to best address it? And certainly in the last 10 years, things have been changing a bit. You can see that from the TV and the news stories. There's a lot of fierce protesting going on, a lot of extremist thinking. There's a lot of mistrust of government. There's a lot of defiance of government. And it's a strange place to be. And I'm not sure exactly what it's going to look like in another 20 years. But things are changing. And it's, I think, a very demanding time right now for police agencies all across North America, but certainly in the U.S.
Yeah, there's so much going on, you know, and the U.S. spills off into Canada, too. So it's a large influence.
It certainly does.
You know, and a lot of negativity about policing mm-hmm. and stuff right now and government and stuff. So,
in that vein, I think a lot will still remain the same. Homicide is still a very rare crime in North America. It's more frequent in the States than in Canada. But there's only so many reasons why you're going to want to kill somebody. And violent crime is always reward-based. There's always some reward being gained by the offender, or you wouldn't do the crime. You wouldn't feel the need to do the crime, whether it's revenge or some type of gain, financial gain, personal gain, personal cause, sexual arousal or gratification or some other emotional expression or ego thing going on. There's only so many reasons you're going to want to kill another human being. And I'm not the guy you'd call in if you had a gang shooting or something like that. You know, that's a crime-based disagreement between two organized criminal groups that are maybe vying for drug trafficking or a particular turf area in a city. I'm not the guy that figures that out. But where you've got interpersonal crime that's committed for, you know, the usual reasons, greed, bad relationship, sexual predation, that type of thing. I expect a lot of that to remain the same. It's been that way since the dawn of mankind. So I expect with some changes, slight changes, it to remain largely the same.
Well, it's been a great conversation. Thank you for taking the time for us today. Our guest today is criminal profiler Jim Van Allen. Thanks for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Jim.
Get the latest news and opinions from Eric Shapiro from the House of Mystery website
in the Shapiro Report.
To find out more about our show, guests, or to listen to past shows from our archive, please go to www.houseofmysteryradio.com.
The mission has been completed.
The end! By George, he's got it! It is the end!
I'll see you.
If you're lying to me, I'll be back.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
Tired of ads interrupting your gripping investigations? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Ads shouldn't be the scariest thing about true crime. Start listening by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/truecrimeadfree. That's amazon.com/truecrimeadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
You've been listening to the House of Mystery radio show. To find out more about our guests, hosts, or shows, go to www.houseofmystery.com.
Show's over for now.
Was it as good for you as it was for me?
Well, good night.
This has been a production of Something Weird Media.
I'll be back.